In a world where uncertainty reigns supreme, where shadows of chaos dance at every turn, one truth emerges unyielding. Preparation is not a luxury, but a lifeline. Behold the Wellness Company, a beacon of readiness amidst the tempestuous seas of fate. Envision a sanctuary of tranquility, where the tumult of unforeseen medical crises finds no purchase. The Wellness Company's Medical Emergency Kit stands as a bastion of assurance, a fortress of resilience against the unseen foes of health. Within its sacred confines lie the tools of salvation. Ivermectin, to ward off the insidious whispers of disease. Emergency antibiotics, to quell the raging storms of infection. Antivirals, to vanquish the relentless tides of contagion, and more. The Wellness Company Medical Emergency Kit is not merely a collection of supplies, it is the embodiment of preparedness itself. Crafted by the hands of esteemed healers led by luminaries such as Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. James Thorpe, Dr. Harvey Risch, and Dr. Drew Pinsky, this kit stands as the pinnacle of safety, the zenith of prevention. These truth-seeking doctors have forged a testament to vigilance, a testament to the unwavering pursuit of well-being. Embrace the certainty that comes from being armed against adversity. Embrace the Wellness Company, for in its embrace lies the promise of resilience, the promise of a brighter tomorrow amidst the chaos of today. Don't wait for the next crisis to strike. Visit twc.health/strangeplanet and use promo code STRANGEPLANET for an exclusive 10% discount. Prepare today and rest easy tomorrow.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. Must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Richard Serrett's Strange Planet. Following the truth wherever it leads. Exposing evil and corruption and the secret machinations of powerful elites. Revealing the high strangeness beneath the surface of our supposed reality. Coming to you from the Great White North and his studio beneath the stairs. Here's Richard.
Every day around the world, thousands of people are placed in medically induced comas. For some coma survivors, the experience is an utter blank. Others lay paralyzed, aware of everything around them, but unable to move, speak, or even blink. Many experience alternate lives spanning decades, lives they grieve once awakened. Some encounter ultra-vivid nightmares, while others undergo a deep spiritual oneness with the universe, or say they have glimpsed the afterlife. Examining the beautiful and disturbing experiences of those who survived comas, Alan and Beverly Pierce explore the mysterious levels of consciousness this near-death experience unlocks. They demonstrate how a key element of the brain is switched off by coma-inducing sedatives, allowing the mind to break free from the body and experience a greater expansion of consciousness. Revealing the dangers of deep sedation and other intensive care procedures, the authors show how comas are unnecessary more often than not, and that many coma survivors go on to suffer lasting cognitive and physical harm. Exploring proven alternatives to medically induced comas, they share tried and tested protocols that are safer for critically ill patients and kinder for patients and their families. And here is the book, Coma and Near-Death Experience, the beautiful, disturbing, and dangerous world of the unconscious. Alan Pierce is a journalist, broadcaster, former BBC correspondent, and author of several books. He's contributed to numerous publications from Time magazine to the Sunday Times of London. Beverly Pierce is a former private investigator who now works as an aromatherapist and a practitioner in yoga-based bodywork. They live in Nouvelle Aquitaine, France, and Beverly not with us, but we're very pleased to have Alan Pierce on Strange Planet. Alan, welcome. How are you?
Yeah, I'm pretty good. Richard, all the better for being here. Thank you so much.
Interesting. I've talked many, many times about near-death experiences on the podcast and other radio shows. This is kind of an interesting take on it. Drug-induced comas and the near-death experience. I mean, is this personal for either you and Beverly, or why did you take a look at this aspect of the NDE?
Well, it's a particularly good question, because we had no intention of doing anything of the kind. It was early on during COVID, during the beginning of lockdown, and we were watching the TV news. And yet again, more and more people were being placed into medically induced comas. And I thought, okay, how does that work? I just wanted to know. And so I just thought I'd check it. I had plenty of time on my hands. So doctors will tell you that it's a essential tool in critical care and has been for about the past 50 years. They don't always refer to it as coma. They tend to talk of sedation, particularly prolonged deep sedation. And that they say it is the deepest form of restorative sleep. They also say that anybody who's on a mechanical ventilator, such as a lot of people were during COVID, that they can't tolerate being conscious, having this great tube down their throat. So that's another reason to place them in a coma. And they also say that comas should be a complete blank in the patient's lives. They're admitted to hospital, they're given a nice deep sleep, they wake up, they're feeling better. Turns out that none of that was true. Where do you want to go from there, Richard?
Well, let's talk about how you researched this. I mean, how many people did you talk to who have been placed in, or how many accounts did you research of people who've been placed in drug-induced comas?
Overall, I spoke to probably touching 100 coma survivors in one way or another. Within the book, there's just over 20 who are, you know, naming themselves, telling their accounts, because they want to share their accounts with other survivors. And they also want to bring an end to the practice of prolonged deep sedation. Finding them, not so easy. When I read the medical explanations for coma, I'm always looking for more answers. So I just thought, oh, look at the other side of the coin here. I'm going to try and find some coma survivors. And I found out on Facebook that there's a group called the Coma Survivors Group. And I spoke to the admins, told them what I was just doing. I was thinking possibly an article or something. They're very, very kindly allowed me to sit on the sidelines and just watch what people were posting. So comas are supposed to be a blank in people's lives. And they're all recounting the most nightmarish events that they experience within coma, particularly doctors and nurses trying to torture and cure them. Others are giving accounts that clearly resemble the near-death experience. Some would appear to be like a near-death experience, but the horrific side of that, absolutely beyond the human imagination in so many cases. And then one or two are recounting alternate lives. But, you know, I've looked into this. I've looked into people going into past life regression, for example. And I think when they do that, they're bearing witness to a past life. Whereas people in coma are experiencing a past life minute by minute. And the book starts with Nick, for example, who goes to hospital, has pneumonia, turns to sepsis, spends 2 weeks in a coma, and spent a minimum of 20 years living in the American Midwest, round about the late 60s and 70s. And, you know, his life was like any other life. You know, he would like play ball with his friends. He'd, you know, go to the game, take his wife somewhere, have kids, go on vacation, a normal life. What should we have for dinner tonight? That kind of normal life. And then springs back into this life. So I found all these different accounts, and they shouldn't be happening. Doctors say these should not be happening. The other thing, they're all reporting remarkably similar ailments, shocking memory loss, diabolical pain, lack of balance, agoraphobia, just becoming reclusive, not sleeping. And regardless of why they were placed in a coma in the first place, they all seem to have very, very similar symptoms. So it seemed to me there were some alarm bells ringing here, and they should have been heard a long time before I turned up. And then I realized I was onto something really important. And then I got to speak to coma survivors, and then they started eventually telling me their stories.
Are there differences between a drug-induced coma and a coma that is brought about just by, you know, a trauma to the body or the head or what have you, in terms of people's experiences?
It will take a lot of surveying, a lot of interviewing to be able to really conclude that. But a number of people in the book found themselves in comas. One was beaten about the head with a hammer during a horrific home invasion. Another was knocked off her motorcycle. They went into spontaneous comas and they were taken into surgery. And at some point they came out of their spontaneous coma. And what often happens, whether it's a spontaneous or medically induced, when people come out of it, or they're brought out of it slowly, they come out kicking and screaming and fighting. It's called agitation. Now, most doctors and nurses want to spare the patient any discomfort whatsoever. So they just turn up the medication again and send them back down. And frequently, they're sending them back down into terrible episodes of torture and chase, and haven't got a clue that they're doing this.
So, again, the doctors would say that these experiences, memories while in a coma, are drug-induced. Why should we suspect otherwise?
Okay. Can you think of any drug or combination of drugs that would allow you to experience an alternate life spanning decades in the period of a fortnight? If such a thing was available, you imagine the commercial possibilities of such a thing, we would all know. I know what is happening. If you look at the brains of Buddhist monks, for example, in deep meditation, you find that there's less activity in their brain rather than more when they're reaching levels of, higher levels of consciousness, when they're communing with the universe. A key part of the brain switches off, called the default mode network. This is the part of the brain that controls our conscious reality. The same thing happens to people who are experimenting with psychedelics. The network switches off. It's been demonstrated that the network switches off when you're placed into a coma. Therefore, all three of those groups are experiencing an expansion of consciousness, not unlike an LSD trip, for example. And that they're seeing the world in a whole different light. And that can be light and dark in terms of the things they see, horror, as well as extreme beauty. On top of that, the human body produces its own psychedelic compound. I can't pronounce it. It's called DMT. Mm-hmm. And it's been shown, for example, that people suffering from schizophrenia have high concentrations of DMT in the urine. Doctors cannot tell you where in the human body it's produced. They can speculate. They can't tell you precisely why it's produced, but they can find it when they look for it. And it's in all of us. It's unethical to prod and probe a healthy patient looking for DMT production. So they use rats and such like in laboratories. They've discovered by inducing heart attacks that DMT levels from the minimum are jumping 600% during the induced heart attack. If that were a human model,
induced coma, I think you meant.
Experience.
Sorry, Alan, well, I think you said heart attack.
Did I say heart attack?
I think you meant
when they induce in a rat a heart attack.
Oh, I apologize.
They get this huge burst of DMT, and it would appear it's a key element in the near death experience, and it's almost like a key opening a doorway. Precisely why we've got it, it would appear that is either helping us to ease our passing, or perhaps it is opening a gateway to what lies beyond. And when I've spoken to people who've come back from coma, they have been to that gateway. They have stood at what lies beyond, as have many people who've recounted near-death experiences. And they've come back and been able to recount these events to me. And these are scientific mechanisms which are demonstrated to have effect on human beings. And I think these are bringing about these effects within coma. They are not, however, understood by doctors in clinical care. They don't understand that their patients are experiencing all these things, and they just think they're in a blank. And they're doing what they're doing because they've always done it, because they're not up to date with current medical literature, which has come on leaps and bounds since COVID, because so many people were placed into medically induced comas, and so many people have been seen to suffer. Suddenly there's, like the blinds have come off, and people can actually see the damage being caused. And there's a group of doctors and nurses who very kindly have helped me with this book, who have seen the light, and they just want to wake up the rest of the intensive care world to something they're doing, which ultimately, with the best of intentions, is killing patients.
Back to more of my conversation with Alan Pierce, co-author of Coma and Near-Death Experience. Back with more in a moment.
Ladies and gentlemen, the captain has turned on the fasten seatbelt sign. We're now crossing a zone of turbulence. Please return your seats and food trays to their upright position and make sure your carry-on luggage is safely stowed. You're about to leave everything you know behind. This is Richard Serrett's Strange Planet. Strange Planet.
Alan Pierce is with us, and the brand new book, Coma and Near-Death Experience, the beautiful, disturbing and dangerous world of the unconscious. How are there any similarities between a spontaneous NDE and the NDE experienced in a drug-induced coma? Are there any similarities?
Okay, for sure. If you look at all the classic things that people list within, as we understand, the near-death experience, and bear in mind, most of the ones we hear tend to be beautiful. There they are in a bucolic landscape, you know, wonderful flowers, for example, beautiful temperature, lovely blue skies. And maybe that they ascend a stairway to heaven. Maybe they meet dead relatives, whatever. That's, let's call it the standard idea of a near-death experience. Every one of those things has been recounted to me by one or other coma survivors. They are, however, and I just don't know if you can call these things near-death experiences, having the flip side of that coin. Not beauty, not peace and tranquility, but abject horror and fear, and that they get trapped in these lives. In many cases, people have told me of multiple lives appearing to be past lives, but they're focusing on their deaths. So listing like a catalogue, one death after another death after another death. One of the coma survivors, James, for example, seemed to almost always drown in one life. There he is. He's flying a light aircraft during a war, gets shot down, drowns in the Thames, River Thames. Another occasion, he's a fisherman. There's an accident of unloading fish, drowns in the water. Another case, he's locked in a box as a torture and drowned. And he's just listing them one after another. And each one of those, if you stop him and say, can we just talk about this one? He can tell you in the infinite detail, in the way I could recount events from my life. And it's lived, absolutely lived. And they're stuck in this. And it's as if when you look at all, I think all major religions will talk of a heaven, a hell, and a purgatory. But we're seeing all three within coma. We're seeing the exquisitely beautiful NDEs. We're seeing these episodes of ghastly horror. And then we're seeing other episodes which are just inexplicable, just so weird. Just can I give you an example of a
yes, please.
Particularly strange one? Deborah, lovely English lady. She's like really smart, really bright and bubbly. Was before her coma. Now she's a shadow of her former self. Within her coma, and let's make this clear, when people are in a coma, they often say things like, well, when they're recounting events, they often say, I woke up within my coma, in the way that you or I might wake up on the sofa and suddenly be back into this level of consciousness. Deborah wakes up in her coma, and a nurse is offering her a job. She's saying, would you like to be a living mannequin in my new bar? It's a serial killer themed bar. And Deborah said, okay. And the nurse says, that's great, because we need people to lie still. Every night, Deborah is on stage, and initially actors would perform terrible murders and rapes and serial killer torture events on Deborah. The bar became very, very popular at the time, and they managed to recruit people being released from prison, rapists and so forth, sex crimes people. And they would reenact their poems in front of a paying audience for Deborah every night. She was there for 80 years, 80 years. She gave birth three times by falling pregnant, by being raped within her coma. In the end, they had to close the bar down and they didn't know what to do with her. So they put her in a wheelchair and they took her to an organ harvesting facility, another feature that crops up from people within coma. And there she ended her life. Now, she could relate that with all the details that the cigarette smoke, the jukebox music, you know, the kind of characters that are in the bar. She lived that. Now, there's no parallel for that that I can find anywhere. And if you think, well, that's a pretty far out, strange story. It's no stranger or more far out than any of the other accounts within this book.
That's absolutely horrific. And she felt as if the 80 years, she was living that out in real time. She felt as if she experienced 80 years worth of life while she was in this drug-induced coma.
You know, since COVID, I have trouble remembering whether something lasted a week or a fortnight or how long ago something happened. So I'm not sure how anyone can accurately say this. But she had landmarks within that, such as the nurse starting the bar, various changes with management within the bar, the different procedures, hiring these different people, having three different children, and then eventually being told, so sorry, Debbie, we're having to close this wonderful bar after 80 years. So that's how she measured that, yes.
Were there people who experienced a full lifetime or decades while in a drug-induced coma, had a family life in the coma, and grieved that life when they were when they came out of the coma?
Many, very many. We focus within that sphere on one story, Nick, within the book. But in the course of researching this, I spoke to a lot of coma survivors, and some were willing to tell me of their other lives. And when they started, they just couldn't continue. They just broke down because they are full of grief. They've lost a partner. They've lost their children. They may have all sorts of things going for them, no doubt had. And just like a flick of a switch, it's gone. They can't explain that to their current partner. You get sent to some psychologist or whatever. They're just going to use terms that imply mental illness, give you some kind of medication to help cure your mental illness. So people honestly just have such difficulty getting it out. So there were two in particular that really haunted me that I spoke to. They just cried. And then we tried to get them to write it down. And they just couldn't begin. They just couldn't begin. So the wonderful Nick McDonald, who's in the story, who I have to say, I would count him as a friend now, the way we've communicated over time. He very bravely has told us things he never told anybody, not even his nearest and dearest. And it's just remarkable, the lies, but the detail of it all.
How do these, maybe you can give us some examples of how these patients who came out of a drug-induced coma, how they then went on to relate to their current circumstances, their current families, particularly if they had a family previously while in the coma.
Yeah, it's not an immediate thing. It's not like in the movies where maybe somebody just wakes up and then they're drinking coffee and, you know, joining in a conversation and asking what year this is. It's not like that. Particularly if you've been on a mechanical ventilator, there's such damage to your vocal cords that you cannot speak for weeks at a time. When people come out of their coma, they might turn the medication off, but it could be weeks before you start opening your eyes. And when you do, you don't know where you are. You don't know who you are. You wonder who all these people in the room are. You find that you can't even move your fingers or toes. You can't communicate in any way. There's people saying, oh, hello, how are you? You know, how do you feel? And you can't respond anyway. You don't know who they are. It takes a long time for them to come to, as it were. As they move down the line, then move from one facility to another, and they've got to learn to walk again, they've got to learn to read and write again, hold a knife and fork again. They're not immediately concerned with events that happened in the past. They're more concerned with how the hell do I get this spoon into my mouth and things like this. That it takes a long time. When eventually it all comes flooding back, and often it comes flooding back as a terrible flashbacks like PTSD. When they try to tell people, they're often said, well, hang on, dear. You know, until recently, you were drugged up to the eyeballs and beyond. What do you expect? So they're just dismissed. And events, such utterly detailed events like Nick's or Debbie's and the others, they're just dismissed. There was a time when near-death experiences were just dismissed. And before that, there was a time when people who experienced them were canonized as saints. Today, it's for many people, it's mumbo-jumbo. But for a growing number of people, it's reality. And this too is reality. And it's one we've just discovered. And I think COVID have opened the door to this discovery. We've just seen now that we've got a gateway to other realities. And coma is doing that inadvertently.
We talked about DMT, which I believe is sometimes referred to as the God particle or the God molecule. The God molecule. Any explanation as to why the drug-induced coma, NDE, is so oftentimes nightmarish? Do you suppose anything to do with, the soul body being trapped in the body while this is happening, as opposed to a spontaneous NDE perhaps happening when the soul leaves the body temporarily? Any speculative thoughts on that?
Yes, really, really good question. Because if you go to the Amazon or where have you to partake in DMT, you're prepping. You would have read up an awful lot about it before you went. You're going to make sure if you're doing this properly, you're going to do it with the right people, in the right setting, in the right environment. And there's everything that you need to process this experience after the event. You will see within that unbelievably nightmarish events, because you're primed for it, you accept it. You might see your own body in front of you and maggots eating your face, for example. That's a fairly common one, certainly one related to me. But they're prepped for that. Someone in a coma who, one minute was on a gurney, next somebody's saying, time now for a nice sleep, finds himself in a world as that experience by people experimenting with ayahuasca, the horrors and the beauty. How the heck do they ever begin to process that? You know, in an ideal world, you shouldn't put people in comas apart from a handful of instances. But let's suppose you had to. One, you should say to them before you go down, oh, by the way, you're going to experience some pretty strange things here, but don't worry. When you come out of it, we'll have a good chat about it. We'll put it all in context for you. And they don't do that. It were the most simple thing to get a coma survivor who understands the process just to talk people, debrief them, as it were, when they came out of it. That doesn't even begin to happen. But it shouldn't happen in the first place. There's only a handful of instances where you should use coma. If someone's undergoing a particular type of brain seizure, if they've got particular wounds like abdominal, have to keep very, very still. If there's particular types of complications after heart surgery where you want to, the brain uses up a lot of oxygen, you want to divert that to the heart. These are generally accepted as the main uses. It's used for so many other things because cash-strapped hospitals that are short-staffed find it expedient just to knock everyone out and turn them over every 2 hours. There's a joke now that people that work in intensive care units that operate these procedures are simply just gardeners because all they ever do is tend and water the vegetables. And this has become commonplace now within medicine.
Did any of the former coma patients indicate to you that they'd wished that they'd passed on? That the fate was worse than death, in other words?
Oh, yeah. So many. I don't even know where to begin on that one. So many who touched death door who, you know, found themselves meeting their dead relatives, had never felt happier in their entire existence, felt that everything was suddenly being explained to them, and then be told to go back. I mean, some of the language used that people felt where they had to go physically, in one case, climb back down some wooden stairs, back down to a field. She was so angry, so angry. Others have said that, okay, I didn't die then. I was sent back because I was led to feel that I had something imperative to do. But I know I'll be going back there. I'll be going back to the best place. I'm really looking forward to that. Others who had really just nightmarish events, just really ghastly nightmarish events, see that as what awaits them when they die. And they don't even want to go to sleep. They just simply don't want to shut their eyes and find themselves back in that world. And they regularly find themselves back in that world. Odd triggers in life, a song on a radio, a strange smell, hands on a television, anything can set people off. And they're destroyed. They're just not the people they were. You know, I mentioned Debbie's story, Debbie, who was 80 years in a serial killer themed bar. You can just tell she was a super vivacious girl, absolutely the life and soul of the party. And she worked in accounts management. She had to juggle so many different things at one time, particularly figures. When she came out of coma, she couldn't manage the figures. She said, my brain had changed. It was as if I'd gone from having a female brain with plates spinning and multitasking to having the brain of a man, only able to concentrate on one thing at a time. And she had completely changed as a person, completely changed. And the way she felt about her relationship, she kept begging her husband to leave her because she is not the woman he married. She is a person pretending to be the woman she married, he married. And they're left with this terrible guilt and just not fitting back into their world.
Another time out. Alan Pierce is with us. Coma and near-death experience, the beautiful, disturbing, and dangerous world of the unconscious.
It's time to redefine reality. This is Richard Serrett's Strange Planet.
Coma and near-death experience, the beautiful, disturbing, and dangerous world of the unconscious by Alan and Beverly Pierce. Alan joins us. As we were having this conversation, I was struck by the notion that life here on Earth, particularly in the last 4 or 5 years, almost seems like a drug-induced coma.
Yeah, doesn't it? I have to keep pinching myself. I keep saying to myself, I am in a drug-induced coma because, for example, I think, you know, I know I've written the first book on a subject that should have been written about many years ago. I'm going to come out of my coma and say to my wife, hey, hon, I've got this great idea for a book. And she'll say, oh, not another damn coma book. Because anyway, that's how I feel. I don't feel anything's real. And since exploring this world, I question everything now about our existence. You know, people tell me things which have greater clarity than this world. And I had a taste of that, just a tiny taste of that. I think I had an NDE. And I really feel that and understand that. And this world feels, it felt more like a game show sometimes.
Yeah.
That we just set various tasks. And I spoke to various spiritual leaders during the course of this book. And some told me that basically we're on a mission. Each time we come back, each reincarnation, we're on a mission. And each time we're here to learn something. Like for me, I have to learn patience. I'm thinking on this life because I'm a really impatient person. And my lesson is wait till, you know, my latter years and get a bestseller or something. Other people are here to learn, I don't know, compassion, empathy, what have you. And I kind of feel that that is right, that we are on some mission. Even the word mission was used to me a couple of times, certainly by Nikid in his coma, that he felt that each of these, the life he's in now, is a mission. The one he was on before was a mission, and that he will be back on other missions. And it just kind of feels right. Everything feels unreal. I don't think COVID helped.
No, I mean, I said the last 4 or 5 years, but really, I suppose, you know, we could go back thousands of years, because this is kind of the purpose of so many philosophies and religions, is how to wake up from a drug-induced coma.
How to wake up when so many come back from their comas. They can't really be convinced. They eventually play along. But they can't really be convinced that this is the real world. If it seems slightly less real than the one they were in, more dreamlike than the one they were recently experiencing, they're not going to trust this world. I've been told that, one woman told me that the whole family, she felt that were being played by actors, that there was no empathy anymore, no connection anymore. It was like being trapped in the plot of Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And so many people will relate that in different ways. And it's definitely a feeling people are left with.
As we contemplate, travel to deep space and, a mission to Mars and things like this, and then we start to think about, placing astronauts in suspended animation, I'm wondering if they might suffer the same fate.
Well, I think you could actually spend a lot less money, give some astronauts some DMT and send them off to another dimension, quite honestly. I think something really serious is being missed here. With so much research going into consciousness, into artificial intelligence and trying to understand the mind, I think a vast amount could be learned from talking to coma survivors. From people who've done ayahuasca, people who've had near-death experiences, they have seen other realities. No doctor or scientist can explain our current level of consciousness, the one we're experiencing now. They haven't got a hope of explaining the levels of consciousness people achieve within coma, so they dismiss them. They might just as well dismiss the level we're experiencing now, because they're two different elements that are equal in so many ways. And they just won't go there. The medical world will not go there. But I think science is heading in that direction because they need to understand, really have a driving financial need to understand the brain. And I think that way people will start to understand what happens to people in coma.
Obviously, you're hoping that the medical community reads the book and takes away some valuable lessons, or at least this will give them pause. Continuing this practice of a drug-induced coma. Have you done any research on alternative methods? As you mentioned earlier, there are perhaps instances where a drug-induced coma is necessary, unfortunately, but they seem to cast the net very widely in terms of its usage. Have you done research for alternative methods of let's say replacing a drug-induced coma with certain patients?
Yeah, very, very many. In the book, I've got a doctor and a couple of nurses explaining very, very clearly what you would do to somebody. Just pick a thing. Let's just say COVID, for argument's sake. You're going to put them on the vent. Before you just knock them out, you actually start to explain to them and say, look, we've got this wonderful life-saving equipment. It's state-of-the-art. What we're going to do, if you're happy with this, you're going to have a little sleep for a few minutes. When you wake up, you'll have this tube in your throat. It's going to feel a bit funny, I assure you. But we're going to just balance your medication so you don't feel any discomfort. So they do that. And as somebody's coming out, they say, hey, it's 20 minutes later. You're back in ICU. And maybe your partner's there. And your partner's stroking your head or your hand or something. And everything is calm and lovely. That's how you do it. It is that straightforward. Because there is an atmosphere in so many intensive care units, not all, that of one of action and swift movement and instant reaction to events, that people just feel they're being swallowed up in things and they're on a gurney and they've been tied down and now somebody's putting something in their arm and hey, presto, they're out of it. The whole way intensive care is run seriously needs to be looked at because it's become a conveyor belt of care, where nobody looks over their shoulder at the damage that they're causing at the product coming off the other end. It all needs reassessment. Everything we say in the book, in terms of this is how to do it right and this is how not to do it right, is backed up in the medical and scientific literature. I wouldn't expect the average reader to do this, but the last 20 pages of the book are taken up listing all that literature, the books, that everything the book is based on is there. If a doctor or nurse that persists in placing people into prolonged deep sedation were to read all of those papers, they would be up to speed. If they read a quarter of those papers, they'd be up to speed. And it is simply a case of people just haven't woken up to something terrible. And COVID, as I said earlier, has helped bring that to the fore. And now there is a real drive towards that, but it's going to take time.
I know the book is just recently published. I don't know if some of the people that you researched that were coma survivors or their families maybe got a preview, but I'm wondering, have you received any feedback from coma survivors or their families or those who lost loved ones? And what did they tell you? And if not, you know, what do you hope to hear?
No, I have. I'm a journalist. I'm not usually happy with showing my copy to the subjects of an article. If I show it to anyone, it's my editor and the lawyers, and that's the end of it. With this, I've been different. I have shared all my research with my group of coma survivors, this 20-odd group of people. At every stage, we've discussed things and we've talked things through. And not all of them, but say about a quarter of them, read the book when it was in its early proof stages and came back and said things like, I wish I'd been given this book when I came out of the coma. I wouldn't have thought I'd gone mad. Those kind of reactions. I've been contacting the coma survivors in the last few days to say the book's out, da-di-da-di-da. And every single one of them has thanked me for what we're doing here, for actually bringing something to the attention that needs to be said. They've all been dismissed. They've been told, oh, you've had an hallucination. You have a false memory. You were just delirious. Don't you worry. It will pass. It doesn't pass in the way that someone who experiences a near-death experience, that stays with them for life. The events within coma stay with them for life, and they have been dismissed until now. So, yeah, have I had much feedback from coma survivors? I've had the most gratifying feedback from coma survivors. And I'll just say this. One of the world's leading experts, if not the leading expert in critical care medicine, wrote the foreword to this book. He is so thankful that we have done this. So do we feel good about it? Yeah, we do. My wife, B, being the private investigator of this team, believes we're really going to get some stick from the medical world. So I'm waiting to see how that pans out.
Alan, congratulations to you and Beverly on a coma and near-death experience. How do we get a copy?
Available from where all good books are sold. There's also an audio book coming. It should be available very soon. It's in production as we speak by the wonderful South African actress, Danny Painter, who just brings these stories to life in a most magical way. So there you go. Available in all good bookstores in formats.
Alan, thank you so much. Great meeting you.
Oh, Richard, thank you so much. Really enjoyed today. Thank you.
A new Richard Serrett's Strange Planet drops every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday.